water leaking.
So we're on Chof Beis Amud Aleph. Now the last thing that we did was present a machlokes tanoim about the following question. Thank you. What is the meaning of Mishnah Torah? One school of thought had it that Mishnah Torah means that the Torah will be given, so to speak, a second time around, and that was by Ezra, with a different Ksav, but not Ksav Ivri, but Ksav Ashurus. And that would explain why at the time of Belshazzar, when the handwriting came out from Shomayim and wrote in Ksav Ashurus, that even the Jewish people themselves, their Chacham, couldn't decipher the Ksav. It was a brand new Ksav that only came into vogue after Ezra. So at that point, at the moment of Daniel, they still didn't have access or familiarity with that Ksav. But then there's another school of thought, and this is headed up by Reb Shimon ben Elazar, and ultimately it goes back in the tradition to Reb Elazar Modoy, that Eino Chinami, the Jewish people had, and even Har Sinai, the original Torah was given in Ksav Ashurus. So Ksav Ashurus was not in any way foreign to them. In fact, Rabbi Lozar Hamodoi ends his discussion by saying that the Mishnah Torah is not that the Torah was given a second time in a different script, but rather that the Melech needs a second Sefer Torah. One Sefer Torah would remain permanently in the treasury, in the Beis Knezov, in the palace of the king. The other Sefer Torah was tied around his arm as a kind of amulet, and it would go out with him so that even when he left the confines of the palace, he would still have Shivisi Hashem Linegdi Summit. V'idach. So let's see where we're up to now. Adaf Chav Beis Amud Aleph. I would say we're probably about 20 lines down from the top. And the Gemara is going to say, V'idach, according to the other Tanoim who rejected Rabbi Elazar, and they hold that there was no Sefer Torah that was Toli Bezroah, right? The Mishnah Torah refers to Ezra giving the second Torah when he gave the Ksav Ashurus, is Hai Shivisi Mai Dorish Bey. It makes sense according to Rabbi Elazar Amodoi that the word Shivisi is going to tell us that the Melech has to have the Sefer Torah to go out with him, and it's attached to his arm. But if you reject that, and there's only one Sefer Torah which is permanently located in the Beis Knezov of the king, then what is Shivisi teaching you? My Dorish Bei Hahu, we use this pasuk Shivisi Hashem Linegdi Samim Iboile Likin Rav Chana Bar Bizno, the Yom Rav Chana Bar Bizno, Rav Shimon Chasido, Hamispalel Tzorach Shiyer Yireh Atzmo Ki Ilu Shchina Kenegno. That when a person stands in tefillah, that he has to imagine as if he is standing in front in the presence of the Shchina. Shenemar Shivisi Hashem Linegdi Samim. The Rambam, for example, tells us that if you don't have in mind that you're standing in front of the Shechina, that's not called tefillah. And Rav Chaim used to say that in the Rambam's frame of reference, what that means is that the definition of a ma'isa tefillah is that you're standing in front of the Shechina. So if you don't have that awareness of Shivisi Hashem, that you're standing in front of the Shechina, then that's not called tefillah at all. Here's the sugya that we're really up to for today. It's about, shall we say, six lines before the Mishnah. And we're up to the Rabbi Shimon. So the first word in the line is Tamid, if that helps you. Is the Rabbi Shimon the Omar who said in the name of Rabbi Elazar Modoi, Ksav Ze Lo Nishtana, which means that there was always, from the get-go, a Ksav Ashurus, a script of Ashurus, and that was well-known and well-circulated, is my, what do we do with the Parsha in Daniel, when the hand of the Malach comes down from Shamayim and writes in Ksav Ashuris, and yet the Pasuk says, Lo Kahalit. Lo Kahalit means they didn't understand it. Ksav Alamikre, that Ksav, that script to read it. They couldn't help the Belshazzar decipher, even the Jewish Chachamim couldn't help Belshazzar. They didn't know how to read the Ksav of the Malach. Well, now you're telling me, Rabbi Elazar ben Doi, that from Kadmus Danan, the Jewish people always knew Ksav Ashuris. It was very familiar to them. The Torah itself was given in Ksav Ashuris. Why couldn't they read the Ksav? And the Gemara offers four answers. Now, I'm going to divide these four answers into two categories for my own logic. It's one against three. The first one is Rav. Rav stands on his own. What do I mean? Everybody except for Rav is going to assume that the letters and the words that were on the wall that appeared in front of Belshazzar at the feast were Mina, Mina, Tekel, Ufarsim. Again, we're going to scramble it in different ways, but those letters, Mina, Mina, Tekel, Ufarsim, they make up those four words, they were written on the wall. The one who disagrees with that is Rav. Rav says that although that's the meaning of what was written on the wall, but that's not what was written on the wall. But rather what was written on the wall is Bigamatria. Now, the gematria here that we're referring to, which is otherwise known as atbash, means that chilufei osios, that, for example, an aleph is replaced by a tav, and a beis is replaced by a shin. Right? So you have two columns going up and down, vertical columns. You have on the right side the aleph beis, which will lead you up to chaf. That means 11 out of the 22 letters are on the right side, going up and down. And then when you move across and go vertically but upwards, you start with the letter Lamed, and that Lamed replaces the Chaf, and you go to the Mem, which replaces the Yud, etc., etc., until you finally get up to the Tuf that replaces the Aleph. So what they saw on the wall was not Mina, Mina, Tekel, Ufarsim, but its equivalent in the Gematria of Atbash, which is Yitas, Yitas, Adach, Pug Chamot. Again, there's no meaning to those words. They don't form words at all. It's just gibberish. It only makes sense if you take, for example, the Yud of Yitas and you convert it to a Mem. Okay, so if somebody could do that for me, take the Yud of Yitas and make it into a Mem. Then you take the Tes of Yitas and you convert it to a Nun. Because in Atbash, Tes is a Nun. And then you take the Tav and you convert it to an Aleph, because the Tav in Atbash replaces the Aleph. So you're left with Mana, or Mina. You do it a second time, you get Mina, Mina. And then you go to Adach, which is the Aleph is going to give you a Tav. The Dalet is going to give you a Kuf.
What does Yud give you? I'm sorry.
Yud? So the Yud always gives you a Mem, right? So you have Mana, Mana, right?
Yeah.
And then you have the tuf of the Aleph, and then the kuf replaces the dalet, and then the lamed replaces the chaf. So you have mina, mina, tekel, ufarsim. Once you decipher the atbash, because every letter in the Hebrew in the Ksav Ashuris now will be a code of for another letter. It parallels, replaces another letter. And if we get all those letters, what we end up is Mina, Mina, Tekel, Ufarsim. But that's not what appeared on the wall. That's according to Rav. So my parish lehu. So what now? Daniel was the one who's the expert who understood what the Malach was conveying. And he explained that Yitas, Yitas, Adach, Pugmachot, etc. is Mona, Mona, or Mena, Mena, Tekel, Ufarsim. Right? If you just go through the Atbash and you replace each letter with its Gematria. So what is the meaning of Mene, Mene, Tekel, Ufarsim, Tekel, Ufarsim? So Mene means to count. In Lashon Kodesh, the Aleph becomes a Hey. Mena means to count. and God counts something which is called Shnosav Shel Adam. In other words, when a person is born into this world, the divine, the heavenly determination is that he'll live X amount of years. In the case of a king, there's an additional counting. He will serve as king for X number of years. After that X is reached and he terminates his credencia, as we call it, then that's it, kaput. He ends his career. So what mana is going to mean is that you, Belshazzar, had a certain number of years that were well counted and well calculated as to how long you would live on this earth and serve as king. And guess what? Nishlamu ashanim shenikzavu lacha. The number of years that were set for you have terminated. Now, tekal is also basically a Hebrew word in which in Aramit the tough replaces a shin. Right? For example, tlas is shalosh, right? So shkel, the word shkel in Hebrew means to weigh something. So what happens is God counts the number of years that Belshazzar has already lived and served as king, and he weighs them. He weighs them on a scale. Why does he weigh them on the scale? He wants to figure out if there's any tzedakah, if there's any goodness in Belshazzar that would allow that we tip the scale and give him another allotment of years. His allotment of years has already exhausted, has terminated, but maybe we'll put him on the scale, we'll find some sort of schus, and as a result of this schus and this tzedakah, we'll give an arichas malchusecha, we'll give him a little bit longer and extend his malchus. But the bottom line is parson. Now the word parson has a double meaning to it. One meaning is lifros. Lifros means to break. And in plural, there were two breakages here. One breakage is that his malchus would be broken, and the other breakage is implicit in the other meaning of the word parson, the root of which is paras. And God took away the malchus of Belshazzar, and which was Bavel, right? That was the kingship of Bavel, and he passed it on to Paras, so that now the malchus will be given to someone else, and that's Paras. So the message for Belshazzar was that, my friend, you have now terminated your existence on this world. You're no longer going to be the king. The kingship is being transferred now. It's broken away from Bavel, and it's now transferred over to Paras. And this is a sad message for Belshazzar, who's sitting there feasting with the clay on Migdash. And he was killed actually that very night. He didn't survive to daybreak of the next day. So that's the meaning of Menei Menei Tkal Ufarsin. So again, as we said, Rav kicks off this whole discussion by saying that those were not the letters that were written on the wall, but rather it was written in a codified form of a gematria called Atbash, and Daniel would be the one to decipher this message and read it as Menei Menei Tekal Ufars. From now on, we have three other opinions as to what confused and confounded the Jewish people when they saw this Ksav Ashuris, and they actually saw these letters. But they didn't see it in a way that they could read it. They were unable to read the letters. Now the most famous of the three opinions that we're about to learn, embark upon, is that of Shmuel. Shmuel says that the letters were written not in gematria, but there's something mishkababbled about the letters. Why is that? Because what they saw with their eyes, this is, I guess in psychology experiments you'd call it eye perception, they saw mamtus ninakfi alaron, which means nothing. It's also gibberish. Now what happens here? If you take these letters and rewrite them in a different sequence, you'll end up with Mina, Mina, Tekel, Ufarsin. But what happened was that these letters appeared on the wall going up and down. He has here a little teeny diagram here on my page. I don't know if you have it in your Gemaras. So if you take it Mina going from vertically from the top to the bottom, and you do that with each of these words, Tekel Ufarsim. Now Ufarsim, somehow, because it didn't fit into the pattern of a three-letter word, and it has six letters, so they split it into two columns. Do you see that? Ufarsin. So you have the Ivav, the Pei, the Resh, and then the Samach, Yud, Nun. So you basically have here five columns. There really should have been four columns, but because the columns are made up of three letters going up and down, so they added a fifth column. Again, that has symbolic meaning, I guess, a fifth column. And that was that they took the Samach, Yud, Nun of Ufarsim and they set it up as a fifth column. Now, Hebrew reads from right to left, not from top to bottom. If I'm not mistaken, don't quote me on this, I think either Japanese or some other language reads from top to bottom. So the Jewish people were not familiar with Japanese. I don't think there were any Jews in Japan at that time. I mean, in 1941, there were a bunch of yeshiva bachurim in Japan running away from the Nazis, but they didn't have a clue that instead of reading it from right to left, as you always read Ksav HaShuris, you should read it in this case from top to bottom. And if they would have read it from top to bottom, and that's what Daniel taught them, they would have deciphered the code that really the letters that they're looking at are Mina, Mina, Tekel, Ufarsin. That's Shmuel. Rabbi Yochanan Omar, he has a slightly different approach to how these letters were Mishkababel. And he says that the letters were written backwards. What does that mean? Each word was written backwards. So for example, Mina, if you write it backwards, is you're left with Aleph, Nun, Mem, right? So Aleph, Nun, Mem is the same if you read it the other way around. Backwards, you read it the other direction, it's Mem, Nun, Aleph. So if you do that times four, what it looks like, it appears on the blackboard, on the wall, is Anom, Anom, Lokas, Nisrafu, which made absolutely no sense because it's actually gibberish. And this was all part of the divine plan to elevate Daniel to the status, or to manifest his greatness as a Chacham, that he was able to decipher this message, which even for the other Chachamim looked like gibberish. And Rav Ashi says that it wasn't that each word was written backwards, but that in each of the four words, the first two letters were written in the opposite order. So what you see here is Nama. Name, okay, we'll read it Name. So Name means that you take the Nun, which is at the beginning of the letter, and you put it as the second letter of the word, and it's replaced by the Mem. So it's Mana, or Mane, Mane, Mane. And then you do the same thing in each of these words. So for example, the last word, it says Parson. And then if you switch the Pei with the Vav of Parson, you get U Parson, which is exactly the last word of the four words. Now, in a machlokas like this, I don't know if there's a psak halacha, because it's not a halachic issue over here. I don't know of any nafkaminas. The question is, what exactly was on the wall? And we have four different versions.
So all four are saying that Ashuri existed previously.
Correct. Okay, so. And these are four explanations to explain the parasha of Belshazzar and the need for Daniel to decipher the message, according to Rav Elazar Modai, who says that the Jews were very, very familiar with Ksav Ashuris. They received the Torah in Ksav Ashuris. And Rav Elazar Modai maintains that there was never a period of time when the Jews lost their connection and their expertise in Ksav Ashuris. So there must have been some sort of a code here. And the Gemara presents four different explanations as to what that code really was.
There's a note here that Rabbaz seems to say that the first luchot were given in Ketzav Asheret, but the second was Ketzav Iver.
Where is that Ramban? In Yisro? In his commentary on the Torah? That sounds like a very interesting...
Here it says it's a response.
Oh, it's in the Tshuva, the Ramban?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if the Ramban was actually the author of those Tshuvas.
No.
It's attributed to the Ramban, but I think it's probably the Rashba. Anyway... So you want to read it out loud again once more time? Is there an introduction or he just has a footnote?
Right.
It's not in the middle of some paragraph? He just straight off? What is this footnote attached to? I'd love to know.
Right. You
know, is there an introduction?
So, they're saying that, the code and the original Torah were written in Ashuri, but...
According to Rabbi Elazar Modoy? Where in the text of every footnote in art school is attached to a text, I think. I don't know. Maybe he has some introductions.
Yeah, I mean this is kind of the end is a conclusion at the end.
Oh, so he gives like a postscript.
Right.
Like a paragraph.
Right, a big paragraph at the end that's kind of explaining.
You mind if I borrow it for a minute? I'll give it right back.
Sure.
Where does it begin?
It starts here.
Okay. He says a simple reading of the Gemara seems to indicate that the Torah and the Luchos HaBris that were presented to Moshe at Sinai were written in Ksav Ivri. And apparently not everyone is going to buy into this. Why? Because Chazal speak in the Gemara and Shabbos, the Gemara Menachos, about the Rabbi Kiva sees that Moshe Rabbeinu was being tola tilin, he was making crowns to the letters of the Torah, and that apparently only applies to the Ksav Ivri.
No, Ashurus.
To Ksav Ashurus, I meant to say. And then the second thing is, how could it be that Hashem himself engraved on the Luchos HaBris a Ksav that can it be that the very ksav in which Hashem himself engraved on the luchos was cast aside by the Jewish people? In other words, what we're saying is that the only nation in the world that actually embraced this ksav called the Ksav Ivri was the Kusim. Mm-hmm. And this Ksav Ivri was the divine Ksav with which God gave the Torah. Furthermore, he says, Rav Chisda says elsewhere that it's the Samach of the Ases HaDibros that miraculously was suspended in Meir. That's the Gemara in Shabbos. Now, according to Ksav Ivri, then it was the ayin that we said, not the samach. So how do we reconcile the two?
Because the ayin is closed.
It's a closed circle. So he starts his reinterpretation of our Gemara with Rabbeinu Chananel. And he says that we accept l'halacha the view, and that was Rabbi Elazar Modai and others, that the original ksav of the Torah was Ashuri. And of course, that's indicated by the Gemara and Shabbos that it was the Samach that was miraculously suspended in midair. The Ritva has a different approach, and he says that the Shtei Luchos HaBris were inscribed in the script of Ksav Ashuri, and the Torah scroll written by Moshe, which was kept in the Kodesh Kadosh, was also written in Ksav Ashuri. And this was the holy Ksav that Moshe observed in the heavens when he went up to receive the Torah. However, he says, neither Moshe nor the people of Israel wished to use God's holy script for mundane purposes. Knowing of its holiness, so they didn't want to use it for everyday language, it would be profaned. And as a result of this reverence, even the Torah scrolls were written in Ksav Ivri. So again, Ksav Ivri is like almost a secular mundane Ksav that was used because Klal Yisrael didn't want to, they felt an awe of the holiness of the Ksav Ashuris. And again, we're going to have to explain what happened at the time of Ezra, how they got over this, so to speak. And he says the following, that when Marzucha Bar Ukva made the statement that the Torah that was given in Ksav Ivri, he's talking about those Torah scrolls, not the original Torah scroll that is in the Kodesh Kadoshim, but rather the Torah scrolls that were written in order to protect the holiness of the Ksav Ashuri. So therefore it comes out that even according to the first Shita, Ksav Ashuri was not new to the Jewish people. So why is it that the Gemara says that it's only according to the second opinion of Rabbi Elazar of Odoi that we have a problem with the episode of Belshazzar? He well, says that...
The impression I got was that Ibn Ezra were no longer exposed to Ksav.
Exactly. That's exactly his answer. He says, since the general populace adopted the Ivri script for everyday use, then as time went on, and they became sort of alienated, they were far away from the Ksav Ashuri because they didn't use it in everyday life, they never really studied what it looked like. And there were only a few great members of Chazal in each generation who passed on the tradition of the Ashuri script. Because again, the Sifrei Torah for popular use were written in Ksav Ivri. So therefore, when we get to the parish of Belshazzar, you know, there was no one around until they got to Daniel who was able to decipher the message, even though it was written in Ksav Ashuris. But this is problematic according to Rabbi Elazar Modoi, because according to him, there was no such thing as a Ksav Ivri. It was always exclusively a Ksav Ashuris. So it must be that it was written in some sort of a code.
But I mean, how can you ignore the fact there was a Ksav Ivri?
Adopted by who? By the Kusim, you mean? Or what are we talking about? Are you talking about Rabbi Elazar Modoi, who says that they exclude? Oh, you're asking, according to Rabbi Elazar Modoi, that Ksav Ashuris is the original Ksav, so what are we going to do with the historical evidence that supports the existence of the Ksav Ivri? That's what you're asking.
Right, that was indeed news.
So I think what Rabbi Elazar Modoi might answer is that there was such a thing as a Ksav Ivri. He's not denying that, and there were peoples on the planet who adopted the Ksav Ivri. But that wasn't the original Ksav of the divine being, nor was it the Ksav of the Jewish people. Now he quotes a Tshuva the Radbaz, who mentions the Yerushalmi, and the Yerushalmi states that if the Torah was actually given in Ksav Ivri, then it was the Ayin that was miraculously held up in the space of air in the Luchos HaBris. And the reason for that is because the Ayin is a letter in Ksav Ivri that is round. Okay, so we discussed this Radbaz at great length yesterday. Then he says the following. The Radbaz maintains that this is only true of the second set of Luchos, Luchos HaShnios, and they were given to replace the broken Luchos following the episode of the Cheta Egel. And he says the following, the original Luchos HaBris that were broken by Moshe were written in Ashuris, and all the teachings which we saw in the Gemara Menachos that were the crowns over the letters, that would apply to the first set of Luchos, but that was all lost when the first set of Luchos were destroyed. So now, where the second set of luchos replaced the first, they are written in Ksav Ivri. And I guess that's maybe a punishment to the Jewish people because of the sin of the Chet Egel. He doesn't say that. I'm just suggesting that. Okay, fine. Rav Osai, let's start the Mishnah. Ein Rochvin al Suso. Now, in the first Mishnah, we said that when a king dies childless and he leaves a brother behind, there's no chalitza. Why? Because there's no possibility of yibum. Why is there no possibility of yibum? Because you're not allowed to marry the wife, the widow of the king. Now, in a similar vein, but again, I wouldn't compare it, our Mishnah is saying that there are other artifacts, so to speak, physical objects that are left behind by the king, and the king used them and enjoyed them during his lifetime as he was a king. And likewise, you know, we have a certain awe of the king, a certain kavod, and we're not allowed to use these objects for our own purposes. So we have a horse that the king rode on, and no one's allowed to ride on that horse after the demise of the king. I'm tempted to think that, again, don't quote me on this, I have no proof, that the king could be mochel on his kavod. This is not a raya, but Remez Ledover would be Achashverosh telling Haman to set up Mordechai on his king, on his horse, right?
He was a Koresh king.
Yeah, I say that's. I'm just giving you a Remez Ledover that you can imagine if the king wants to give kavod to someone and he says, let him ride my horse, that could be okay. It could be. But in the case of Chalitza and Yibum that we discussed before, and the Iser of marrying the widow of a king, there I don't think Mechila would be meaningful. Haraya, even after death, it doesn't work. In other words, that's a separate din that a woman that was married to the king, there's an Iser Nisuin that prohibits marriage to this woman because she was once married to the king. Rabbi Yehuda in our Mishnah, if you recall, allows another king to marry the widow of a king, and that's how David married the widow of Shaul. But other than the king himself, no one else is allowed to marry the widow of a king. And I think that's an Iser Nisuin. It's not just the mitzvah's covered, because if it's not an Iser Nisuin, I don't know why it would undermine Chalitza and Yibum. You know, just because it's covered, I don't know if that's enough to completely remove the concept of Chalitza and Yibum. V'ein Yoshim al Kiso, and we don't sit on his throne. Let's say he has a chair. Again, I'm assuming that this chair was designated for the king. That's called Kisei Shalom Melech. If, for example, the king wakes up and they're having a pizza party and he sits down in a particular chair, I don't know if that generates any dinim, but we're talking about that kisei that was the designated throne for the king. No one's allowed to sit there. The ein mishtamshin b'sharvito, and we're not allowed to enjoy the benefit of his what's called a scepter in English?
Scepter.
And the reason for that is because, again, this was a utensil that was used by the king. And the Rambam adds a whole other list of kelim, like his keser, for example, you know, the crown that he puts on his head. And then the Rambam generalizes it. V'lo b'shar klei tashmishim hamiuchadim lo. In other words, those utensils that were designated for the use of the king in an exclusive way, no one's allowed to benefit from them. And the subject of this Mishnah is Kavod HaMelech. Ein Rohen Oso Kishu Mistaper. You know, he bears his head in order to have a haircut, and the Isuk, involvement in getting your hair cut is something that's considered a davashal kiur. It's a little bit embarrassing. It's indicative of the lower elements of man's physicality. It's a gnai, and if people see him in that state, then that undermines his cover. Velokshu arum, and if he's naked, you're not allowed to see him. And then, oddly enough, the Mishnah says "V'lo k'shu b'beis hamerchatz." I mean, that lechora is just a repetition of k'shu arum. So, in the note here, he quotes two sources: the Melechet Shlomo and the Chazon Yecheskel, to give two different answers to this. According to the interpretation of the Melechet Shlomo, even though we already know that you're not allowed to see the king when he's naked, the Mishnah wants to add, you're not allowed to see the king even if he's not naked in a place where people normally go naked. And that's a Beis HaMerchatz. And the Chazon Yecheskel says that we're talking about a case where he's clothed, but only halfway clothed. In other words, he's basically naked, but he wraps, let's say, a towel around himself or a bathrobe or something, and his erva is covered, but nevertheless he's still considered osek b'merchatz. And osek b'merchatz, like the case of osek b'tispores in the case of a haircut, is something that's below the dignity of a king. So we're not allowed to watch him while he's in the bathhouse. And now the Mishnah summarizes the entire Mishnah in one principle, and that is Shenemar Som Tasim Olecha Melech Shetehei Moso Olecha, that we have to have a certain awe of the king. He represents Malchus, and in all these cases that we mentioned earlier, it would be to lower that awe, that aim of, and that covet of the king, if we would see the king in those compromising situations, or if we would enjoy the objects that are dedicated to the use of the king. Omar Rav Yaakov, Omar Rav Yochanan. Now the Gemara embarks on a sugya called Avishag. She was the girl that she had never been married. She was brought to David in his older age in order to warm him up in his bed. Keep in mind, David had already maxed out the number of wives that he was allowed to marry, which is 18. And now the question would be, since David didn't marry Avishag, then Almanuso Shel Melech that we discussed in the first mission in this chapter would not apply to Avishag. She's not a widow of the king. She was never married to David. Oh, so the Mishnah says, don't misunderstand. No one is allowed to marry Avishag except for the king, meaning another king who replaces the first king. And this is an extension, as Rashi points out here, of the halach of Sharvito Shel Melech. You remember that we said Sharvito Shel Melech, etc. That Sharvito Shel Melech is just one example of any object that was used by the king to benefit the king. It was designated for the king's benefit. No one is allowed to benefit from that object. And presumably, that Isser applies even after the death of the king. In the case of Avishag, she was, so to speak, an object that was designated for the pleasure of the king, to warm up his body. And therefore, no one is allowed to marry this woman and have benefit from this woman, called Avishag, with the exception of the king, who would replace David HaMelech. And that's called Muteres L'Shlomo.
This is despite most commentary to say they did not have relations.
Didn't.
Correct. The pasuk itself,
because they didn't have
right. The verse itself says they. Again, had they had a relationship, then she would be married to him. But again, as I said before, he maxed out already in terms of how many women he would be married. He could divorce one and marry her. But be that as it may, had he married Avishag, then I wouldn't need the statement of Rav Yaakov in the name of Rav Yochanan that no one's allowed to marry her after the king's death, because we have already in the first Mishnah, the halach of Almanuso Shel Melech, no one's allowed to marry except for another king, the almana of a melech. But she's not the almana of a melech. What she is the Sharvito Shel Melech. What does that mean, Sharvito Shel Melech? I mean, she's not a Sharvit, but she's a person that was designated for the pleasures of the king, and therefore she has no less of a status than Sharvito Shel Melech, right? Than any object that was designated for the pleasure of the king. However, this one person on the face of the earth who's allowed to benefit from Avishag, and that's Shlomo, because he's the king who will replace his father. And he's not marrying his father's wife, which would obviously be an Erev Doraisa, because she was never married to her father. But he wants to benefit from a Sochenet. She was, as we'll see in the Pasuk in a minute, she was brought in as a Sochenet to warm up his body. And now Shlomo wants to either marry her, or maybe he wants to make her into a Pilegesh, or perhaps he wants to use her as a Sochenet. You know, he gets cold at night. And all of that would be mutter. It doesn't say that Shlomo actually took advantage of the heter. But the most important part is the flip side. And that is Asur l'Adoniyah. Now, if you remember the story, Adoniyah, who is also a son of David HaMelech, albeit from two different mothers, two different wives of David, but he was a half-brother to Shlomo, and he has his eyes set on the kingship. He wants to take over after David dies. So when David is an old man, he goes into Bathsheba, and he says to Bathsheba, he wants to know if he could invite Avishag into his privacy so that he will warm up his body with Avishag. And in a sense, Adoniyah naively thinks that Bathsheba is going to be able to be the conduit here to relay the message to David and see if David would allow this. Now it is possible, as I said before, that David could be mochel on his covenant. Maybe he would allow it. But in truth, the message never even got to David HaMelech because it was intercepted by Shlomo. When Shlomo found out that his mother Bathsheba was, so to speak, commissioned by Adoniyah with this mission to get a permission from David for Adoniyah to have a relationship with, as a sochenet, let's say, with Avishag, Shlomo was smart enough to reveal exactly what Adoniyah's intention was all about. You know what I mean? What was he thinking, Adoniyah? Did he just want to have Avishag? He would really want to marry Avishag, which, again, he's only allowed to do if he is the Melech, and he would use his relationship with Avishag as kind of like getting his foothold in the kingship. And as a result, Shlomo HaMelech had him put to death, because Shlomo HaMelech realized that he was usurping the Malchus. So when it says Muteris l'Shlomo v'asur l'Adoniyah, it's like two sides of a coin. She's Muteris l'Shlomo because he's going to be the replacement king for David. She's Asur l'Adoniyah because he is not the replacement king. And Avishag's status is that of Sharvito Shel Melech. So that's what Rabbi Yochanan now sort of embellishes, he explicates. He says, Muteris l'Shlomo de Melech haya u Melech mishtamish b'Sharvito Shel Melech. But Asur l'Adoniyah de Hejotu. Hejot means he's not a Melech. And a hedgehog is not allowed to enjoy the benefit of the Sharvit Shel Melech, as we saw in our Mishnah. And this sheds a light on the whole parasha of how Shlomo revealed the true intention of the plan, the scheme, the you know, the dream of Adoniyah to take over the Malchus. Because when he went into Bathsheba to mention to the king that he wants Avishag, you know, to warm up his bed, then Shlomo HaMelech understood that he saw himself as the king. And that gave him the status of a Morid B'Malchus. Now the Gemara asks a very strange question. Avishag Maihi. So the Marsha tries to embellish this question. What does it mean, Avishag Maihi? And he explains the following. Our assumption is that Avishag's status is Sharvito Shel Melech, but not Almanuso Shel Melech. Now that's a bit of a problem. Why? Because if David was not married to Avishag, then how is he allowed to have this, you know, relationship which is called Sochenet, where she would come into his bed and warm him up at night? That's a violation of an Isur Yichud Pnuya. Now keep in mind that the Torah never prohibited Yichud with a Pnuya, being alone in a private place with a non-married woman. But the Rabbanan had enacted that Isur in the aftermath of the Maisa of Amnon and Tamar, which had taken place during the lifetime of David HaMelech. So when we get up to David's older age, it's already beyond the enactment of Yichud Pnuya. In fact, it was David's Beis Din that actually voted to formulate or accept this enactment, this Siag, this Isur Pnuya. So we're sort of in a bind. You know, it's on the one hand, we seem to be assuming in this whole sugi of Rabbi Yochanan that Avishak's status is that of Sharvito Shomelech. She's not Almenuso Shomelech. And it was never a marriage relationship between Avishak and David HaMelech. Then how could David have used her as a Sochenet and violated the Isur of Yichud, in this case Yichud with a Pnuya? So first of all, the Gemara wants to clarify, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that there was no marriage relationship between Avishag and David. There had to have been some sort of special heter, if you will, a special matir, we call it. You know, they gave him license to quote-unquote violate the Isur Yichud of a Pnuya because David HaMelech was so freezing at night in his older age that we needed to somehow keep him alive, you know, keep him warm. The pasuk says, "Vamelech David zaken bo bayamim." I'll read a few more lines in the Torah, in the Tanakh itself. It says, "Vayichasuhu b'bgadim." They covered him over with quilts. Velo yichamlo. And nevertheless, it didn't warm him up. And this, according to the Gemara Brachos, by the way, has something to do with the fact that David was punished for cutting off the corner of the. Yeah, how do you say me'il in English?
A cloak?
The coat of Shaul HaMelech. The Medrash says, K'shera David es HaMalach omed b'Yushalayim b'char b'yodu nitztane. There's another possible interpretation which Rashi quotes here, that David saw that the Malach was already coming into Yushalayim with a cherub b'yodu. You know, this was a harbinger of what would ultimately be the Churban, the destruction of Yerushalayim. So David became frozen, so to speak. And nothing could warm him up. Uksiv. So what do they do? They have to help David HaMelech. It's really a shasakana. So it says in the pasuk, Vayomru lo avadov yivakshu ladoni HaMelech nara besula v'yomdo lifnei HaMelech usehi lo sochenes, meaning that she should warm him up, v'shachva b'cheikecha, and she'll lie in your bosom, v'cham la'adoni HaMelech, and that will warm you up. V'ksiv v'ayivak shunar yofa, v'chol gvul Yisrael, v'yimtsu es avishag hashunamis, v'yaviu osa la'melech. V'ksiv, and it says, v'anara yofa ad mi'od, v'tehi la'melech, sochenes, v'tesharseyu. And then the pasuk says, Ruvain, to answer your question, Vamelech lo yida'ah, which means he didn't marry her. Sometimes the Torah, when it wants to talk about marriage, it uses the word yidia. Like it says, Vayeda adam es ishto, right? So the word yidia means to consummate a marriage. So it's, the pasuk goes out of its way to say that Avishag was the socheres for David. She was Meshamesh David, and therefore she was singled out like any other object or utensil for the benefit of the king. And she had a din, therefore, of Tashmisho Shel Melech, or Sharvito Shel Melech. Now, here in the footnote, he asks, why did they have to find the Nara Yofa? What does her physical beauty have to do with it? And he says the following. Sharotza David Lashuv al Chait Batsheva. David was looking for a rectification for a sin of Batsheva. Batsheva was a very beautiful woman, and that allured him to sin. Whatever the nature of the sin was, again, that's Sugyan and Shas and Ksuvis and Gittin. Al Kain Bikshu Nara Yofa Lahagdil Tshuvaso, to intensify his tshuva, his repentance, his rectification. Sha'af al gav shehi came yifas toar, she's so beautiful, never eno bol leha, he doesn't have a relationship with her. And by the way, fellas, in case you think that the reason why he didn't have a relationship with her is because he was an old man, so hold your horses, because that's the greatest mistake that we could ever have, we could ever make. David HaMelech was very capable of consuming a relationship with Avishai, as we'll soon see. Now, in the footnote here, he quotes the Sanhedrin Akhtana, who in turn quotes a Rashba. Shekirva Dirabonon Asura Afil Lechol She'ein Bo Sakon. And that seems to imply that you're not allowed to violate an Issa Dirabonon of Kreva. Kreva means coming close to a woman that you're not allowed to marry, even though the whole Issa is only Dirabonon. And even in the case of a Chola, is therefore kosher. Heich Ovar David Al Issa Yichud Shel Pnuya. And he answers that David was not a chol she'ein bo sakana, but rather David was a chol she'yesh bo sakana. Because the pasuk says, ki sovim gadim v'lo yicham lo. I don't know, is there something called when you take your temperature and it could be below normal?
Yeah, hypothermia.
Hypothermia. So I guess David was suffering from hypothermia, like Jews of the Holocaust. You know, they had hypothermia. It's a very dangerous situation. Now, I don't understand, and I never understood, why one of his other 18 wives wouldn't have done it. But that's what it says. He needed a young, beautiful girl to do. Maybe again,
they were older. They didn't have as much warmth.
Warmth. And maybe also because this would intensify his tshuva. This was also an opportunity, a method by which he could do tshuva for what he did with Bathsheba. So the Gemara now continues and tells us a little bit about the inner scoop, you know, the dialogue between David and Avishag that was enclosed doors. Amra. So Avishag turns to David and she says, Nitzavim. You know, she also had aspirations. She also wanted to have an opportunity to marry the king. There's a whole discussion here about, as we'll soon see, she thought that he was incapable of consummating an intimate relationship. And the question here that they vacillate back and forth on is, what would be the purpose of instead of her, you know, lying with him in bed as Sochenet warming is up and marrying him, what was her purpose in wanting to marry him? If she, Lishitasa, believed that he could not consummate the marriage. And furthermore, the question is exacerbated because it seems that the Rofim, who were trying to save David's life, came to the conclusion that he needed a Sochenes Pesula. He needed a woman who was never married, which again touches on my question from before, why he couldn't just lie with one of his 18 wives. He needed a basula. So he says the following, Tzarech Lomar, I think he's quoting the Sam Sofer, I'm not sure, Tzarech Lomar shel rotzasa elashi kare shmo aleha. That her desire was more of a subtle conceptual kind of status change, that she wanted to be able to say, I am married to David HaMelech, and David's name would now connect and cling to her. So she had these aspirations of being more than just a sochenet for David. So she says to him, Nitzavan, why don't we get married? Amallah, asirasli. What does that mean, asirasli? Literally translated, asura atli, I'm not allowed to marry you. And the answer is that he was already married to 18 wives. He can't take a 19th wife. Amallah, so she suggests that maybe he's bluffing, meaning he's giving a... You know, she thinks it's no problem for him to divorce one of his 18 wives and marry her. So why is he giving her this whole story, this whole baloney story? She gives him a mashal. an idiomatic phrase, chasrei leganav, let's say a ganav can't find anything to steal, is nafshe l'shlama nakid. So he boasts that he became a tzaddik. That the reason why he's not stealing is because he wants to be a proper citizen. You know, he's no longer a ganav. When in truth, the reason why he's not stealing is because he has nothing to steal. There's nothing around that he can successfully abscond with. And the nimshal here is that the reason why you don't want to marry me is because you don't have the capacity to consummate that marriage. You're too old and weak, and that's why that's the true reason why you're refusing to marry me. You're embarrassed about the fact that you're so old. So instead, what you do is you blame it on Issa. You make yourself look like a tzaddik, and you're not allowed to marry another woman. So now David decides that he's going to prove that she is wrong, and that the reason why he doesn't marry her is simply because he doesn't want to divorce any of his other 18 wives. So Amalahu, he tells his haizbacha, you know, his servants, Kiru li labas sheva, call in Batsheva my wife, and I'm going to demonstrate that Batsheva will testify to this effect that I am capable of of intimacy. Uksiv, and it says Vatavo Batsheva l'melech achadora, and the end of the pasuk says Vamelech zaken miod, Vavisha gashunamis mishores es hamelech. Now I'm not sure if she was actually present at the time that he had 13 different intimate acts with his wife Batsheva. I don't know. I'd like to think that she was, outside the room. And again, why is Batsheva being called to the Melech Chadara, into that room, in order to prove to Avishag that what he said to her, and the reason why he didn't marry her is because of the 18 wives, is really true. It's not because he's embarrassed that he cannot consummate the marriage. And Omer Rabbi Yudah Barab, he also saw Kincha Batsheva B'Sholosh Esrei Mapos. She had to wipe off the sperm with 13 different cloths, because 13 different occasions, one after the other, he had a relationship with her. Now, where does the number 13 come from? So if you look in the Pasuk, Rashi points out that the Pasuk, again, anybody who wants to help me out here counting to the number 13, there are 13 words in this Pasuk. Vatavo, who wants to count for me? Right? Bas, Sheva, El, Hamelech, Hachadora, Vamelech, Zaken, Miod, Vavishag, Hashunamis, Mishareis, Es, Hamelech. Hopefully, nobody counted. All right, but it should be 13. All right. Omer Rav Shamon Bar Abba Bo Re'e Kamakoshe Gerushim. In other words, we're really in a choice situation. David is urgently needs a sochenet. Now, what we could do is, because we're in a bind here, we need, you know, to save David's life, we need Avishai to sleep in his bed. So we have two choices. We could either let Avishai, as an unmarried, not married to David, remain in his bed, which would be a kind of a violation of the Issur Yichud. As we said, the Issur Yichud was already enacted earlier in history. Or, why not encourage David to divorce one of his 18 wives, Nishkefelech, right? And then he could marry Avishag, and there would be no violation of the Issur Yichud. And the answer is Kamakoshe Gerushin. How terrible it is in the eyes of the Torah to divorce your wife. Shari David Amelch Hitiru Lo Liyached. They would rather allow him, permit him to violate the Issur Yichud, Velo Hitiru Lo Ligarish. And they didn't allow him to encourage him to
willy-nilly magarish is not.
All right, you don't divorce your wife simply for that. Again, there is a reason why he wants to divorce, but what did this woman do that she deserves to get a get?
Yeah.
So there's no siba gedola here. There's no siba chazaka to divorce this woman. And from this point on, the Gemara engages in a long discussion about divorce. This is a real classic Agadita, and why divorce is something terrible.
would he have a conjecture